This is an ABC podcast.
This week, the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, posted a photo of him in front of a barbecue. He wasn't frying up some sausages. He was making a curry. He loves making them and posting about it on social media. On this episode of Hack, what young South Asian people think about that and what's behind his curry-making obsession, the one he wants to tell everyone about all the time. Hello, Avani Dias here. And later on this episode, antidepressants, they go such a long way in helping people work through their mental health, but they can also have some unwanted consequences affecting your sex life. We're going to talk about the young people who've had to deal with that and why it happens. And Australia is about to kick off its first space mission to the moon, and it'll help researchers figure out if humans can live up there.
Hack. There's a rumour going around that I like cooking curries. I'm pleased to say it's true.
On Triple Jack.
All right, full disclosure, I am Sri Lankan. My parents make great curries, but I'm not very good at it. And it can be pretty demoralising when you see the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, old mate from the Shire in Sydney, appearing to cook a better curry than me. He loves posting about it on socials. This week, he posted a photo on Instagram of him making an eggplant, chicken and saag curry with the caption, Saturday night curry night. But the posts have drawn criticism from, young South Asian Australians for being tokenistic, saying his government's policies tell a different story. What do you think about Scott Morrison's curries? Text in 0439 757 555. Meghna Bali has this story.
Look, we all know ScoMo likes cooking up a storm. It's comforting to know it's Indian food and he listens to Bad Boy Butcher.
It just feels a little bit like he's maybe trying to stay relevant and, dare I say, curry favour from his Indian population. Seems a little transparent.
The PM, Scott Morrison, is a busy man. But when he can, he likes cooking for his wife and kids. Sometimes it's a scomosa, but his favourite dish to make is usually a curry. And he makes sure his efforts are well publicised, posting photos of the process to his social media accounts. His latest venture? Chicken, eggplant and saag curry. Ingredients I'm not sure go together, but go off, I guess. He posted some snaps of himself cooking this curry on a barbecue on Saturday.
There's a rumour going around that I like cooking curries. I'm pleased to say it's true.
But look, not everyone in the Aussie Indian community is feeling so stoked about the curry happy snaps.
I mean, to be honest, my initial thought was that's as Aussie as it gets, right? Like a curry on a barbecue, that's a new one. But yeah, with everything that's gone on in the past year, it is tempered slightly different than previous posts.
This is Riya Nath. She's a young Indian journalist from Sydney, and she's talking here about the way her community's been treated during the pandemic.
The major focal point that comes to light here would obviously be the travel ban that was implemented in April, where essentially Australia closed its borders to travellers returning from India, which included its own citizens and residents, and they threatened heavy fines or perhaps even imprisonment.
At the time, Australia had paused all direct flights from India as the country grappled with a deadly wave of COVID that was killing thousands daily. Within days, though, the government backtracked on their threats to jail people for trying to get home to Australia. But Riya says the message was startlingly clear.
It almost made them feel like second-class citizens because you didn't see such strict travel bans being implemented in the US or in the UK when they had similarly devastating outbreaks as well.
Riya hasn't seen her family for almost 2 years. She's an international student, so she was allowed to go to her home country, but she would have joined the thousands of stranded Aussies we still haven't let back in.
Your mental health really does take a toll, and like many other cultures, in Indian culture as well, there is such a closeness of family. And apart from just cooking curries, I do wish that political figures would take things like that into account.
Closed borders aren't the only gripe. The PM's been criticised for a boat trophy he kept in his office to celebrate his rejection of asylum seekers, many who are from South Asia and locked up in indefinite detention, or his refusal to intervene in the attempts to deport the Tamil family, who the regional community of Bilawila is desperately fighting to protect. But despite these tough policies that often affect South Asian people, he's still pushing the curry-making content on his socials.
It does feel a bit tokenistic. There does feel a need for understanding a culture beyond just the delicious foods.
So what's Scott Morrison trying to do?
So I think it's not a stretch to suggest that there is some kind of political point here about trying to emphasise his closeness to the South Asian community, perhaps?
Kishore Napier Raman is a federal politics reporter at Crikey and says that closeness is pretty beneficial for a PM with an election looming.
Indian migrants are a really fast-growing migrant group, and a lot of these are sort of socially conservative voters in the suburbs of big cities, the kind of migrant group that Labor has perhaps not done well enough to hold on to.
Kishore says strengthening our relationship with India serves an important economic purpose too.
Particularly in higher education, it's a big export coming from India as well, and that's kind of been in a lot of trouble through the pandemic. And then there's obviously the geopolitical stuff as well.
Okay, but what does cooking curries on Facebook have to do with all of this?
Even if people saw through it and saw it as cynical, it still resonates and it still puts him out there in networks that he might perhaps not reach as easily all the time.
Kishore's right. The PM's usual posts about policy may clock a couple thousand likes, but photos of him cooking a curry, they usually get a casual 30K. Rhea says while these posts don't go unnoticed by the community, that doesn't guarantee their support.
There is certainly a very politically conscious diaspora that's understanding their place in the country, and they don't want to be taken for granted anymore. So where Skomosas might have won favor once upon a time, I think the past year has really made people question why these curry nights are coming up.
Pat on Triple J.
Meghna Bali with that story. A lot of people texting in, and I think it's pretty hilarious. The very first text we got was actually a recipe for a red curry with pumpkin. The whole thing's listed there, so that's good to know. Someone's texted, Scotty should try doing some actual work. Someone else, I'm anything but a fan of Scott Morrison, but I don't see why it matters if he's obsessed with curry. Would be nice if he was this passionate about the environment, though. Let's chat a bit deeper about this because, yeah, a lot of people being like, who cares? Does it matter that he's making this curry? Karishma Kalyanda is a councillor in Liverpool in southwest Sydney. She's also from the local Indian community and she's run for Labor in previous elections. Thanks so much for coming on the show. We just heard how much the Prime Minister obviously wants to connect with migrant voters in Australia and in his electorate in Sydney. Is being into curries actually going to work? We are going to see an election in the next year or so.
Thanks, Vani, for having me. Look, I think multicultural voters from different cultural backgrounds are kind of aware of the nuances of politics. And so, like Rhea mentioned in the package, you know, it's nice for people to sort of see their culture reflected back from the, you know, the Prime Minister of the country. And I guess for a lot of people like myself, who when we went to school, turning up with a curry in your lunchbox wasn't necessarily the most popular thing in the world. It's really kind of a very different point of reflection. But when you look at whether that is reflected in his attitudes and his policies and whether he actually really does care about diversity, does care about, you know, communities from different cultures, the proof is in the pudding. So everything from the border closures to South Asia earlier this year and even his discomfort with using the word multicultural to describe Australia says to us that it's a very superficial way of engaging with communities.
Karishma, someone has texted. It's from Dan in Sydney who says, who cares what Scott Morrison cooks? He can cook whatever he wants. We are a multicultural country. How good? And obviously migrants, there would be some who are critical of policies to do with these communities and so on, but they're not a homogenous group. And there would be a group that actually like the fact that Scott Morrison's making an effort to connect with their culture in this way, right?
Absolutely. And like I said, you know, in the past sort of 20 to 30 years, we have really shifted from, you know, things like food being a source of difference to us being really proud of the fact that we have so many different varieties of cuisine and we can easily access them, particularly in our larger cities. And so I think that's nice to see your culture reflected in that way and people respond to that accordingly. But at the end of the day, we really need to see that it goes deeper than that, that it goes, that it's not just tokenistic. And frankly, we don't see that in Scott Morrison and his government.
Someone has texted as well, the PM's performative curry cooking is as fake as the rest of his social media professional photo shoots. Karishma, often when we talk about multiculturalism in Australia, it's always put out there as sort of like a thing we should celebrate. But, you know, for people who don't get it, why is it tokenistic when it is just on the food level and not anything further than that?
Because food is just one aspect of how we engage with each other as a society. And as you mentioned, I'm a representative for one of the most multicultural areas in Southwest Sydney, and my community has suffered greatly over the last 4 months because of some of the really harsh restrictions and the lockdown associated with the pandemic. And part of that has to do with stereotyping, has to do with perceptions of what our community is like, and you know, everything from what our family situation is like to how we how our support networks work, through to who is who can access government assistance. And the part of the reason why our community suffered so much was because governments didn't actually take the time to listen, to engage appropriately, and to then feed that information back into effective and constructive policy. And that's the reality of the situation, because food is one element of it, but at the end of the day, what actually matters is how governments affect people's daily lives. And the Scott Morrison government has shown that they really don't take people from multicultural communities very seriously on that front.
And you know, a lot of people texting, oh, who cares that he's making the curries? That's a valid point, but obviously he is posting about them. He's not just making the curries behind the scene. He's posting them on his social media pages. They're getting huge traction and he's getting a lot of kudos for that. But Karishma, just quickly before we go, you know, a lot of politicians, prime ministers try to put on this sort of normal guy image, right? Tony Abbott had the budgie smugglers, which was actually a bit weird. Kevin Rudd had the handball at schools for some reason, which was also kind of strange. Scott Morrison's got the curries. Why is it, do you feel, that politicians need to put on that kind of persona? You're an up-and-coming politician. What's your thing?
Relatability is kind of something that's worth its weight in gold when it comes to how you connect with your community, right? And, you know, if you can, even on social media, show that you are a normal person, that you're not just some sort of, you know, alien in a lizard suit, that you actually kind of have the same kind of hopes, goals, dreams, aspirations as your neighbour or the person down the street or whatever, it builds a sense of respect and trust. And that's what most politicians and most public representatives are trying to do. They're trying to build trust. They're trying to build a sense of connection. But it has to be backed by authenticity. And that's the really important thing. If it's not backed by authenticity, as one of your listeners said, it's fake and therefore it's not effective.
That was Karishma Kalyanda, a councillor in Liverpool in southwest Sydney. She's also from the local Indian community and she has run for Labor in previous elections. Josh in Fitzroy's texted, I'm no fan of Scott Morrison and won't be voting for him, but he's making an effort and we should support any efforts, even if we're wary. And someone else, all Scotty cares about is marketing. It's all a visual thing, especially with an election coming.
Hack. One small step in announcing this, but a giant leap for Australia heading to the moon for the first time in history.
On Triple J.
This is Hack. My name's Avani Dias. And could you live in space? Australia is about to launch our first mission to the moon. The National Space Agency is going to send a rover there, which will ultimately help find out if humans can live in space. It's being promoted as a way for Australia to enter the world's space missions, and the government says it's about creating more jobs in this sector. It'll cost $50 million. Anthony Murfett is from the Australian Space Agency. Thanks for coming on the show. So tell us about this rover, which will be sent from Australia to the moon, that's being developed in Australia.
Yeah, it's great to be here this afternoon to talk to you all. And it is an exciting day. So earlier today, the Prime Minister and the Minister for Science and Technology announced that the Australian Space Agency signed an agreement with NASA to send a small Aussie rover, about 20 kilos in size, to the surface of the moon. And this is really, really exciting because it's leveraging some of the great capabilities we have here in Australia in our automation and robotics areas in the resources sector. So people see those big yellow trucks what we're doing is taking the technology that automates them and allows them to drive by themselves and put them into a little rover and work with NASA and put it on the surface of the moon. And what's also exciting, when it's on the surface of the moon, it's actually not about the rover. It's going to be there. It's going to pick up the lunar soil or the earth, and it's going to pass it over to a project run by NASA that will try and extract a form of oxygen, which is really important, of course, one, so that we can breathe when we're on the surface of the moon, but it's also a potential source of fuel.
Yeah, and one part of that is obviously the ability to potentially send humans and have sustainable life up in space. Can you explain how that could work going forward if you do discover through the rover that that sort of form of oxygen is around?
Yeah, so one of the reasons that there's a big focus on looking at activities on the moon is it's around a three-day trip. And that means that we can sort of undertake these type of experiments to identify, is there oxygen? Is there, for example, the soil or the regolith? One thing you can also do is use the material to 3D print infrastructure, even replacement wheels. So it actually creates a range of experiments to test that sustainability. Because when you're on the surface of the moon, you don't want to be shipping things from Earth all the time because it's really expensive to get into orbit and then onto the moon. So being able to look at what we can use in situ or on the surface of the moon becomes really, really important. And these type of missions are the first stepping stone there. And what's exciting about this as well is it means that Australia has the capabilities, and the audience we're talking to today can now, when they're either going to school, at university, or thinking about what they want to do in their career, we can do space and we can do it here in Australia.
Yeah, that's obviously a big element of this. You know, people, it's a classic thing, dreaming of going to space when you're a little kid, but ultimately in Australia, it would probably mean having to move overseas, but this would mean more jobs potentially. What could it mean in terms of possibilities for young people in working in the space industry?
That's right. And this is what's really exciting about this. Firstly, we're side by side with NASA, but our vision here at the Australian Space Agency is to create another 20,000 jobs by 2030 and triple the size of Australia's space sector from 4 billion to 12 billion by 2030. And these type of missions become really important. One, they inspire. We want kids, we want the younger generation to be able to look to the sky and know that Australia has technology up there. So it means it's engineers, it means it's data scientists, because not only are we talking about robotics, there's other missions such as satellites that take images of the Earth to help bushfire. So it means that we want data scientists, but we also want communicators and, excitingly, space lawyers. As we think about people undertaking more activities in space, it's actually opening up a very big economy, and it's forecast to be $1 trillion by 2040 around the globe. And Australia now has a seat at the table and providing those opportunities for people to have jobs in the sector.
All right, before we let you go, obviously it is a very exciting thing that Australian technology will be up there. How are we going to distinguish it? Will it be like green and gold rover or, you know, some kind of koala thing up there? Any Australian insignia going on?
Well, that's right. So we've got to think through what that will look like. I think we're very keen. We'll see the Australian flag. And that's what I always usually say, space and dinosaurs inspire. We've got space and we're going to be able to point to an Australian flag, what it looks like and how we make it unique. We're yet to think through, but what we know is we've got Aussie ingenuity, and the audience that is listening into this, we really want to put their minds to what they could look like, but not just this mission, what the future missions could look like, and know that Australia is going to be in space.
Maybe you can put a Triple J drum on it, you know? That's the audience would love that. Anthony,
that's right, I think the audience would love it.
Thanks so much for coming on the show. Anthony's from the Australian Space Agency.
Hack. Some of the ones I was on, I couldn't bring myself to ejaculate, regardless of what I did. And some of the other ones was the complete opposite.
On Triple J.
All right, antidepressants, they can be a massive life changer if you've been in a world of pain, but they can have some intense side effects, like losing your sex drive and affecting intercourse in ways that can devastate people. Millions of Australians are on antidepressants. If you're one of them, call me 1300 055 36. Want to know if you face this? Jackson Worthington has this story.
It made me a lot more premature than I'd ever been before. Felt like I wouldn't be able to satisfy a new partner or anything like that.
That's Alex. He's got anxiety and depression. He's been on and off antidepressants for nearly 9 years. The Australian Institute of Health and Welfare reckons more than 3.1 million Aussies were prescribed antidepressants in 2019-20, just like Alex. And that was before the pandemic started. These meds are meant to help people improve their mental health, but just like everything else, they have some side effects.
When you first start on one, you get quite a lot of like nausea. I had one where I had some insomnia as a side effect and didn't sleep for about a week. In terms of side effects that continued on, there was some sexual dysfunction, which changed from medication to medication. Some of the ones I was on, I couldn't bring myself to ejaculate, regardless of what I did, and some of the other ones was the complete opposite, where, you know, a flick of the switch would do it.
Over the past 9 years, Alex's meds have had a pretty big impact on his sex life and his relationships.
At points, my partner at the time would feel, you know, inadequate because they could not bring me to ejaculate, but it was entirely due to the medication, as it was never previously an issue. It gets frustrating, especially one of the ones I was recently on after being single for a while, and it made me a lot more premature than I'd ever been before, and that kind of made me less interested in seeking out anything because I felt like I wouldn't be able to satisfy, you know, a new partner or anything like that.
Alex isn't alone in his frustration. Nick started taking antidepressants just after starting uni. Basically, just as he started dating, he started to deal with these side effects too.
You feel incomplete in a way. You don't feel like you're normal. It can definitely hurt your self-confidence and would affect the way that you interact with people, especially women, in that kind of setting. My girlfriend was very supportive, and to be honest, it probably frustrated me more than anything. You kind of feel bad in a way because you're letting down the sexual experience.
Okay, so there's no doubt these medications help a lot of people. But why do so many of them screw up your sex life?
Most antidepressants work by changing the levels of hormones in our brains. And we know that depression is linked to an imbalance in some of these hormones.
That's Dr. Anna Semecki. She's a medical advisor at MPS MedicineWise, a non-for-profit that helps people understand how to safely use their medications. She says sexual dysfunction is a super common side effect of antidepressants.
One of the most commonly used classes of antidepressants, called selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, those drugs increase the levels of serotonin in the brain, which leads to the desired effect of stabilising mood. But because the brain is so complex, it can also lead to some unwanted side effects.
Talking about your sex life with the doctor can be awkward, but Dr. Semecki says it's important to keep them in the loop with how you're going.
It's almost impossible to predict how an antidepressant will affect an individual because side effects vary from person to person. It's really important that patients be open and honest in their communication with their doctor. We know sexual health is something many are embarrassed to talk about, but if you do notice a change or a problem, please, please, please don't hesitate in raising this and voicing your concerns. Doctors are used to these discussions. We deal with them regularly, but we won't know what's going on unless you tell us.
Those sorts of discussions led to Nick and Alex both coming off their medication. Nick says more people should have the chat.
You don't need to feel any sort of shame or anything like that. There's a lot of stigma about taking antidepressants, but the people that aren't reaching out and asking for help, those are the ones that are really doing damage to themselves.
Hack on Triple J.
Jackson Worthington there. Let's go to Karadjuri woman Lauren French, who is also a sexologist. Thanks for coming on Triple J. We just heard antidepressants massively increase your serotonin in your brain. So how does that then affect your sex drive?
Hi, Avani. Thanks so much for having me on. So when we're talking about particularly SSRIs in antidepressants, we're talking about increasing the serotonin in the body. And that increase is going to lead to us being more calm, less anxious, which is really great when we're kind of dealing with anxiety, depression, these sort of things. But we're also basically turning our libido right down. Those hormone messages aren't really getting to the brain when we're getting aroused, turned on, which can lead to those physical symptoms where we're not able to get erections, get lubricated, etc.
Someone texted, I trialled 2 antidepressants this year and decided to stop both of them because they absolutely kill my sex drive and ability to orgasm. It affected my relationship, took away one of the few things I was still enjoying in life. Lauren, how do you distinguish whether it's the antidepressants or your actual depression?
Great question, because both can lead to negative sexual outcomes. Depression can obviously have a huge impact on our sex drive, on our libido and sexual function, just as much as an antidepressant can. So I think it kind of depends on when we look at depression. Are we having these difficulties before the antidepressants? And once we're on the antidepressants, are they lasting for quite a long time? With, you know, sexual function stuff, a lot of it we can manage, even if you're on or off antidepressants, with help with through therapy, sexology work, etc. But it is really hard for us all to determine exactly what's causing it, because it, you know, there's no way to know going in before you start taking them.
Someone texted, I've been rejected by guys because I can't orgasm on my antidepressants, so now I fake it. Zaira from Swan Hill, I'm a girl. I've been on a number of antidepressants for nearly 10 years. It's completely obliterated my sex drive. A few people, Lauren, saying, you know, it has destroyed their relationships. How do you talk to a partner when these issues are coming up?
I think open communication is always the cliche, but it's a cliche for a reason. And I think also how we're viewing our sex life and how we're viewing, you know, sexual satisfaction. So often sex is so goal orientated for people. It is about erections. It's about orgasms. And actually, you know, how do we reframe our sexual world so that we're actually focusing on things like pleasure and fun? And I think, you know, then if we're having issues with erection, we're having issues with libido, we can still kind of work on that with our partner, but our partner has to have the same kind of expectations going in. So it is about kind of having that conversation of what we're able to do sexually, what helps us sexually, you know, particularly times of day, different, you know, around our antidepressants, and kind of getting them on board so that we look at this as, you know, a team effort towards how we best have the best sex we can.
Sarah's called in. What was your experience on antidepressants? Sarah, you there?
So with my, yeah, I'm there. With my experience, I found that with my partner, we used to be able to have like really, 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 really good sex. And I, obviously I'm on antidepressants and I am on SSRIs. They weren't necessarily great for like other diagnoses that I have, but for the anxiety and panic disorders, it's hard because you can't really notice if they're effective while you're on them. But when I wasn't, you could really, really tell. And so while our sex life is kind of struggling in that aspect, just because I'm also asexual, so we've struggled with that originally, but we kind of put it down to the fact that even if I stop taking the medication, that's not really a win for us, because then I'm at risk to myself. So it was sort of like, sure, establishing what was more worthwhile, whether it was my low mood but having great sex, or me not really being able to feel anything at all, and that's not just sexually but also, yeah, emotionally, like feeling completely flat but not being of harm to myself, if that makes sense.
No, it totally does, and I think that's obviously an issue that a lot of people are weighing up. Sarah, I really appreciate you calling in and speaking about something that's so personal to you, but it is something, the text line's going off, it's something that a lot of people are experiencing. Lauren, Sarah's brought up a really good point there. How do you weigh up that preference, you know, dealing with your mental health and stabilizing your mood versus, you know, dealing with your sex drive and so on? Because it's probably personal preference, but it is a hard decision, right?
It is a hard decision, and I think we all need to understand that, you know, mental health is hugely important, but sexual health also affects our mental health and affects our overall life. So I think, you know, it's kind of not always a this or that moment either. I think it is about open discussions with our doctors, with our providers around, you know, are there other medications we can try? Can we try a lower dosage? And if, you know, we find a medication that works but still not quite working for our sex life, can we work with other people around how do we, you know, help foster our libido, help, you know, put some things into place, whether it's around timing of sex. And yes, we might lose a little bit of spontaneity, but we still might be able to create a really satisfying sex life with ourselves as well as our partner. So I think it is that, you know, it's not always quite a decision, but I think we need to not lessen the sexual health, and we can't obviously lose our mental health either.
Hack on Triple J.
That is Lauren French, sexologist. Thanks so much for joining us. See you next time.